I never thought. John, the books. Have you ever seen their like? There are thousands.
He gazed about him. The library at Winterfell has more than 100. Did you find the maps?
Oh, yes. Sam's hand swept over the table, fingers plump as sausages, indicating the clutter of books and scrolls before him. 12, at the least.
He unfolded a square of parchment.
The paint has faded, but you can see where the map maker marked the sites of wildling villages, and there's another book. Where is it now? I was reading it a moment ago.
He shoved some scrolls aside to reveal a dusty volume bound in rotted leather.
This, he said reverently, is the account of a journey from the Shadow Tower all the way to Lorne Point on the frozen shore, written by a ranger named Redwine. It's not dated, but he mentions a Dorin Stark as King of the North. So it must be from before the conquest. John, they fought giants. Redwine even traded with the Children of the Forest. It's all here.
Ever so delicately, he turned pages with a finger.
He drew maps as well, see?
Maybe you could write an account of our ranging, Sam. He'd meant to sound encouraging, but it was the wrong thing to say. The last thing Sam needed was to be reminded of what faced them on the morrow. He shuffled the scrolls about aimlessly.
There's more maps, if I had time to search. Everything's a jumble. I could set it all to order, though. I know I could. But it would take time. Well, years, in truth.
Mormont wanted those maps a little sooner than that. John plucked a scroll from a bin, blew off the worst of the dust. A corner flaked off between his fingers as he unrolled it.
"Look, this one is crumbling," he said, frowning over the faded script.
"Be gentle."
Sam came around the table and took the scroll from his hand, holding it as if it were a wounded animal.
"The important books used to be copied over when they needed them. Some of the oldest have been copied 50 times, probably."
"Well, don't bother copying that one.
23 barrels of pickled cod, 18 jars of fish oil, a cask of salt." "An inventory," Sam said, "or perhaps a bill of sale. Who cares how much pickled cod they ate 600 years ago?
John wondered.
"I would."
Sam carefully replaced the scroll in the bin from which John had plucked it.
"You can learn so much from ledgers like that. Truly you can. It can tell you how many men were in the Night's Watch then, how they lived, what they ate."
"They ate food," John said, "and they lived as we live."
"You'd be surprised. This vault is a treasure, John."
"Well, if you say so." John was doubtful. Treasure meant gold, silver and jewels, not dust, spiders and rotting leather.
"I do,"
the fat boy blurted. He was older than John, a man grown by law. But it was hard to think of him as anything but a boy.
"I found drawings of the faces in the trees and a book about the tongue of the Children of the Forest. Works that even the Citadel doesn't have. Scrolls from old Valyria. Counts of the seasons written by maesters dead 1,000 years.
"The books will still be here when we return."
"If we return."
"The old bear is taking 200 seasoned men, 3/4 of them rangers. Corran Halfhand will be bringing another 100 brothers from the Shadow Tower. You'll be as safe as if you were back in your Lord Father's castle at Horn Hill." Samwell Tarly managed a sad little smile.
"I was never very safe in my father's castle either."
"The guards play cruel jests," John thought. "Pip and Toad, all a lather to be part of the great ranging, were to remain at Castle Black. It was Samwell Tarly, the self-proclaimed coward, grossly fat, timid, and near as bad a rider as he was with a sword, who must face the haunted forest. The old bear was taking 2 cages of ravens, so they might send back word as they went. Maester Aemon was blind and far too frail to ride with them, so his steward must go in his place. "We need you for the raven, Sam, and someone has to help me keep Gren humble." Sam's chins quivered.
"You could care for the ravens, or Gren could, or anyone," he said with a thin edge of desperation in his voice. "I could show you how. You know your letters, too. You could write down Lord Mormont's messages as well as I."
"I'm the old bear's steward. I'll need to squire for him, tend his horse, set up his tent. I won't have time to watch over birds as well. Sam, you said the words. You're a brother of the Night's Watch now."
"A brother of the Night's Watch shouldn't be so scared."
"We're all scared. We'd be fools if we weren't." Too many rangers had been lost the past 2 years, even Benjen Stark, John's uncle. They had found 2 of his uncle's men in the wood, slain, but the corpses had risen in the chill of night. John's burnt fingers twitched as he remembered. He still saw the white in his dreams, dead Uther with the burning blue eyes and the coal black hands, but that was the last thing Sam needed to be reminded of. "There's no shame in fear," my father told me. "What matters is how we face it. Come, I'll help you gather up the maps." Sam nodded unhappily. The shells were so closely spaced that they had to walk single file as they left. The vault opened into one of the tunnels the brothers called the Worm Walks, winding subterranean passages that linked the keeps and towers of Castle Black under the earth. In summer, the Worm Walks were seldom used, save by rats and other vermin. But winter was a different matter. When the snows drifted 40 and 50 feet high, and the ice winds came howling out of the north, the tunnels were all that held Castle Black together. Soon, John thought, as they climbed. He'd seen the harbinger that had come to Maester Aemon with word of summer's end. The great raven of the citadel, white and silent as ghost. He had seen a winter once, when he was very young, but everyone agreed that it had been a short one, and mild. This one would be different. He could feel it in his bones. The steep stone steps had Sam puffing like a blacksmith's bellows by the time they reached the surface. They emerged into a brisk wind that made John's cloak swirl and snap. Ghost was stretched out asleep beneath the wattland door wall of the granary, but he woke when John appeared, bushy white tail held stiffly upright as he trotted to them. Sam squinted up at the wall. It loomed above them, an icy cliff 700 feet high. Sometimes it seemed to John almost a living thing, with moods of its own. The colour of the ice was wont to change with every shift of the light. Now it was the deep blue of frozen rivers, now the dirty white of old snow, and when a cloud passed before the sun, it darkened to the pale grey of pitted stone. The wall stretched east and west as far as the eye could see, so huge that it shrunk the timbered keeps and stone towers of the castle to insignificance. It was the end of the world. "And we are going beyond it." The morning sky was streaked by thin grey clouds, but the pale red line was there behind them. The Black Brothers had dubbed the wanderer Mormont's Torch, saying, only half in jest, that the gods must have sent it to light the old man's way through the haunted forest.
"The comet's so bright, you can see it by day now," Sam said, shading his eyes with a fistful of books.
"Never mind about comets. It's maps the old bear wants." Ghost loped ahead of them. The ground seemed deserted this morning, with so many rangers off at the brothel in Molestown, digging for buried treasure and drinking themselves blind. Gren had gone with them. Pip and Haldren Toad had offered to buy him his first woman to celebrate his first ranging. They wanted John and Sam to come as well, but Sam was almost as frightened of whores as he was of the haunted forest, and John wanted no part of it. "Do what you want," he told Toad. "I took a vow." As they passed the sept, he heard voices raised in song. "Some men want whores on the eve of battle, and some want guards." John wondered who felt better afterwards. The sept tempted him no more than the brothel. His own guards kept their temples in the wild places, where the weirwood spread their bone-white branches. "The seven have no power beyond the wall," he thought, "but my guards will be waiting." Outside the armory, Sir Andrew Tarth was working with some raw recruits. They'd come in last night with Conwy, one of the wandering crows who roam the Seven Kingdoms, collecting men for the wall. This new crop consisted of a grey beard leaning on the staff, two blonde boys with the look of brothers, a foppish youth in soiled satin, a raggy man with a club foot, and some grinning loon who must have fancied himself a warrior. Sir Andrew was showing him the error of that presumption. He was a gentler master at arms than Sir Alistair Thorne had been, but his lessons would still raise bruises. Sam winced at every blow, but John Snow watched the sword play closely.
"What you make of them, Snow?"
Donald Noy stood in the door of his armory, bare-chested under a leather apron, the stump of his left arm uncovered for once. With his big gut and barrel chest, his flat nose and bristly black jaw, Noy did not make a pretty sight. But he was a welcome one, nonetheless. The armourer had proved himself a good friend. "They smell of summer," John said, as Sir Andrew bull-rushed his foe and knocked him sprawling. "Where did Conwy find them?"
"A lord's dungeon near Gulltown," the smith replied. "A brigand, a barber, a beggar, two orphans, and a boy whore. With such do we defend the realms of men."
"They'll do," John gave Sam a private smile. "We did." Noy drew him closer.
"You've heard these tidings of your brother?"
"Last night, Conwy and his charges had brought the news north with them, and the talk in the common room had been of little else." John was still not certain how he felt about it. Rob, a king, the brother he'd played with, fought with, shared his first cup of wine with, but not mother's milk, no. So now Rob will sip summer wine from jewelled goblets, while I'm kneeling beside some stream, sucking snow melt from cupped hands. "Rob will make a good king," he said loyally.
"Will he now?" The smith eyed him frankly. "I hope that's so, boy, but once I might have said the same of Robert."
"They say you forged his warhammer," John remembered.
I was his man. A Baratheon man, smith and armourer, at Storm's End until I lost the arm. I'm old enough to remember Lord Stepfren before the sea took him, and I knew those three sons of his since they got their names. I tell you this, Robert was never the same after he put on that crown. Some men are like swords, made for fighting. Hang them up, and they go to rust."
"And his brothers?" John asked. The armourer considered that a moment.
"Robert was the true steel. Stannis is pure iron, black and hard and strong, yes, but brittle the way iron gets. He'll break before he bends. And Renly, that one, he's copper, bright and shiny, pretty to look at, but not worth all that much at the end of the day."
"And what metal is Rob?" John did not ask. Noy was a Baratheon man. Likely he thought Joffrey the lawful king and Rob a traitor. Among the Brotherhood of the Night's Watch, there was an unspoken pact never to probe too deeply into such matters. Men came to the war from all of the Seven Kingdoms, and old loves and loyalties were not easily forgotten, no matter how many oaths a man swore, as John himself had good reason to know. Even Sam, his father's house was sworn to Highgarden, whose Lord Tyrell supported King Renly. Best not to talk of such things. The Night's Watch took no sides. Lord Mormont awaits us, John said.
He won't keep you from the old bear.
Noy clapped him on the shoulder and smiled.
May the gods go with you on the morrow, Snow. You bring back that uncle of yours. Do you hear?
We will, John promised him. Lord Commander Mormont had taken up residence in the King's Tower after the fire had gutted his own. John left Ghost with the guards outside the door.
More stairs, said Sam miserably as they started up. I hate stairs.
Well, that's one thing we won't face in the wood. When they entered the solar, the raven spied them at once.
Snow!
The bird shrieked. Mormont broke off his conversation.
Took you long enough with those maps?
He pushed the remains of breakfast out of the way to make room on the table.
Put them here. I'll have a look at them later.
Thoran Smallwood, a sinewy ranger with a weak chin and a weaker mouth hidden under a thin straggle of beard, gave John and Sam a cool look. He had been one of Alistair Thorne's henchmen, and had no love for either of them.
The Lord Commander's place is at Castle Black, lording and commanding, he told Mormont, ignoring the newcomers. It seems to me.
The raven flapped big black wings.
Me.
If you are ever Lord Commander, you may do as you please, Mormont told the ranger. But it seems to me that I've not died yet, nor have the brothers put you in my place.
I'm First Ranger now, with Ben Stark lost and Sir Jeremy killed, Smallwood said stubbornly. The command should be mine.
Mormont would have none of it. I sent out Ben Stark and Sir Waymar before him. I do not mean to send you after them and sit wondering how long I must wait before I give you up for lost as well.
He pointed.
And Stark remains First Ranger until we know for a certainty that he is dead. Should that day come, it will be me who names his successor, not you. Now stop wasting my time. We ride at first light, or have you forgotten?
Smallwood pushed to his feet.
As my lord commands.
On the way out he frowned at John, as if it were somehow his fault.
First Ranger? The old bear's eyes lighted on Sam. I'd sooner name you First Ranger. He has the effrontery to tell me to my face that I'm too old to ride with him. Do I look old to you, boy?
The hair that had retreated from Mormont's spotted scalp had regrouped beneath his chin in a shaggy grey beard that covered much of his chest. He thumped it hard.
Do I look frail?
Sam opened his mouth, gave a little squeak. The old bear terrified him.
No, my lord, John offered quickly. You look strong as a...
Don't cousin me, Snow. You know I won't have it. Let me have a look at his maps.
Mormont pored through them brusquely, giving each one no more than a glance and a grunt.
Was this all you could find?
My lord, Sam stammered, there were more, but the disorder.
These are old,
Mormont complained, and his ravens echoed him with a sharp cry of,
Old, old.
The villagers may come and go, but the hills and rivers will be in the same places, John pointed out.
True enough. Have you chosen your ravens yet, Tarly?
Master Aemon means to pick them come evenfall after the first feeding.
I'll have his best, smart birds, and strong. Strong,
his own bird said, preening.
Strong, strong. If it happens that we're all butchered out there, I mean for my successor to know where and how we died.
Talk of butchery reduced Samuel Tarly to speechlessness. Mormont leaned forward.
Tarly, when I was a lad, half your age, My lady mother told me that if I stood about with my mouth open, a weasel was like to mistake it for his lair and run down my throat. If you have something to say, say it. Otherwise, beware of weasels.
He waved a brusque dismissal.
Off with you. I'm too busy for folly. No doubt the maester has some work you can do.
Sam swallowed, stepped back, and scurried out so quickly he almost tripped over the rushes.
Is that boy as big a fool as he seems?
The Lord Commander asked when he'd gone.
Fool!
The raven complained. Mormont did not wait for John's reply.
His lord father stands high in King Renly's councils, and I had half a notion to dispatch him. No, best not. Renly is not like to heed a quaking fat boy. I'll send Sir Arnel. He's a deal steadier, and his mother was one of the green apple Fosways.
If it please my lord, what would you have of King Renly?
The same things I'd have of all of them, lad. Men, horses, swords, armor, grain, cheese, wine, wool, nails. The Night's Watch is not proud. We take what is offered.
His fingers drummed against the rough-hewn planks of the table.
If the winds have been kind, Sir Alistair should reach King's Landing by the turn of the moon. But whether this boy Joffrey will pay him any heed, I do not know. House Lannister has never been a friend to the Watch.
Thorne has the White's Hand to show them. A grisly, pale thing, with black fingers it was, that twitched and stirred in its jar, as if it were still alive.
Would that we had another hand to send to Renly.
Dywin says you can find anything beyond the wall.
Aye, Dywin says.
The last time he went ranging, he said he saw a bear 15 feet tall.
Pshaw! Mormont snorted. My sister is said to have taken a bear for a lover. I'd believe that before I believe one 15 feet tall. Oh, in a world where dead come walking. Even so, a man must believe his eyes. I have seen the dead walk. I've not seen any giant bears.
He gave John a long, searching look.
But we were speaking of hands, How is yours?
Better. John peeled off his moleskin glove and showed him. Scars covered his arm halfway to the elbow, and the mottled pink flesh still felt tight and tender. But it was healing. It itches, though. Maester Aemon says that's good. He gave me a salve to take with me when we ride.
You can wield Longclaw, despite the pain?
Well enough. John flexed his fingers, opening and closing the fist the way the maester had shown him. I am to work the fingers every day to keep them nimble, as Maester Aemon said.
Blind he may be, but Aemon knows what he's about. I pray the gods let us keep him another 20 years. Do you know that he might have been king?
John was taken by surprise. He told me his father was king, but not, I thought him perhaps, a younger son.
So he was. His father's father was Daeron Targaryen, the second of his name, who brought Dorne into the realm. Part of the pact was that he wed a Dornish princess. She gave him 4 sons. Aemon's father, Maekar, was the youngest of those, and Aemon was his 3rd son. Mind you, all this happened long before I was born, ancient as Smallwood would make me.
Maester Aemon was named for the Dragon Knight?
So he was. Some say Prince Aemon was King Daeron's true father, not Aegon the Unworthy. Be that as it may, our Aemon lacked the Dragon Knight's martial nature. He likes to say he had a slow sword but quick wits. Small wonder his grandfather packed him off to the Citadel. He was 9 or 10, I believe, and 9th or 10th in the line of succession as well.
Maester Aemon had counted more than 100 name days, John knew. Frail, shrunken, wizened and blind, it was hard to imagine him as a little boy, no older than Arya. Mormont continued,
Aemon was at his books when the eldest of his uncles, the heir apparent, was slain in a tourney mishap.
He left two sons, but they followed him to the grave not long after, during the great spring sickness. King Darren was also taken. So the crown passed to Darren's second son, Ares.
The Mad King? John was confused. Ares had been king before Robert. That wasn't so long ago.
No, this was Ares the First. The one Robert deposed was the second of that name.
How long ago was this?
Oh, 80 years, or close enough, the old bear said. And no, I still hadn't been born, although Aemon had forged half a dozen links of his maester's chain by then. Ares wed his own sister, as the Targaryens were wont to do, and reigned for 10 or 12 years. Aemon took his vows and left the citadel to serve at some lordling's court, until his royal uncle died without issue. The Iron Throne passed to the last of King Darren's four sons. That was Maekar, Aemon's father. The new king summoned all his sons to court and would have made Aemon part of his council, but he refused, saying that he would usurp the place rightly belonging to the Grand Maester. Instead, he served at the keep of his eldest brother, another Darren. Well, that one died too, leaving only a feeble-witted daughter as heir, some pox he caught from a whore, I believe. The next brother was Arian.
Arian the Monstrous?
John knew that name. The prince who thought he was a dragon was one of old Nan's more gruesome tales. His little brother Bran had loved it. The very one, though he named himself Arian Brightflame. One night, in his cups, he drank a jar of wildfire, after telling his friends it would transform him into a dragon. But the guards were kind, and it transformed him into a corpse. Not quite a year after, King Maekar died in a battle against an outlaw lord.
John was not entirely innocent of the history of the realm. His own maester had seen to that. That was the year of the Great Council, he said. The lords passed over Prince Arian's infant son and Prince Darren's daughter and gave the crown to Aegon.
Yes and no. First, they offered it quietly to Aemon, and quietly he refused. The gods meant for him to serve, not to rule, he told them. He had sworn a vow and would not break it, though the High Septon himself offered to absolve him. Well, no sane man wanted any blood of Arians on the throne, and Darren's girl was a lackwit besides being female, so they had no choice but to turn to Aemon's younger brother, Aegon, the fifth of his name. Aegon the Unlikely, they called him, born the fourth son of a fourth son. Aemon knew, and rightly, that if he remained at court, those who disliked his brother's rule would seek to use him. So he came to the wall. And here he has remained, while his brother and his brother's son and his son each reigned and died in turn, until Jaime Lannister put an end to the line of the Dragon Kings.
King,
croaked the raven. The bird flapped across the solar to land on Mormont's shoulder.
King,
it said again, strutting back and forth. He likes that word, John said, smiling.
An easy word to say. An easy word to like.
King,
the bird said again. I think he means for you to have a crown, my lord.
The realm has three kings already, and that's too many for my liking.
Mormont stroked the raven under the beak with a finger, but all the while his eyes never left Jon Snow. It made him feel odd. My lord, why have you told me this about Maester Aemon?
Must I have a reason? Mormont shifted in his seat, frowning. Your brother Rob has been crowned king in the north. You and Aemon have that in common, a king for a brother.
And this, too, said John, a vow. The old bear gave a loud snort, and the raven took flight, flapping in a circle about the room.
Give me a man for every vow I've seen broken, and the wall will never lack for defenders. I've always known that Rob would be Lord of Winterfell. Mormont gave a whistle, and the bird flew to him again and settled on his arm.
A lord's one thing, king's another.
He offered the raven a handful of corn from his pocket.
They will garb your brother Rob in silks, satins, and velvets of 100 different colours while you live and die in black ringmail. He will wed some beautiful princess and father sons on her. You'll have no wife, nor will you ever hold a child of your own blood in your arms. Rob will rule, you will serve. Men will call you a crow. Him they'll call Your Grace. Singers will praise every little thing he does, while Your Grace's deeds all go unsung. Tell me that none of this troubles you, John, and I'll name you a liar. And now I have the truth of it.
John drew himself up, taut as a bowstring. And if it did trouble me, what might I do, bastard as I am?
What will you do? Mormont asked. Bastard as you are.
Be troubled, said John, and keep my vows.
Sansa. The invitation seemed innocent enough, but every time Sansa read it, her tummy tightened into a knot.
She's to be queen now. She's beautiful and rich, and everyone loves her. Why would she want to sup with a traitor's daughter?
It could be curiosity, she supposed. Perhaps Margaery Tyrell wanted to get the measure of the rival she'd displaced.
Does she resent me, I wonder? Does she think I bear her ill will?
Sansa had watched from the castle walls as Margaery Tyrell and her escort made their way up Aegon's High Hill. Joffrey had met his new bride-to-be at the King's Gate to welcome her to the city, and they rode side by side through cheering crowds. Joff glittering in gilded armour, and the Tyrell girl splendid in green, with a cloak of autumn flowers blowing from her shoulders. She was 16, brown-haired and brown-eyed, slender and beautiful. The people called out her name as she passed, held up their children for her blessing, and scattered flowers under the hooves of her horse. Her mother and grandmother followed close behind, riding in a tall wheelhouse whose sides were carved in the shape of 100 twining roses, every one gilded and shining. The small folk cheered them as well.
The same small folk who pulled me from my horse and would have killed me, if not for the hound.
Sansa had done nothing to make the commons hate her, no more than Margaery Tyrell had done to win their love.
Does she want me to love her too?
She studied the invitation, which looked to be written in Margaery's own hand.
Does she want my blessing?
Sansa wondered if Joffrey knew of this supper. For all she knew, it might be his doing. That thought made her fearful. If Joff was behind the invitation, he would have some cruel jape planned to shame her in the older girl's eyes. Would he command his king's guard to strip her naked once again? The last time he had done that, his uncle Tyrion had stopped him, but the imp could not save her now.
No one can save me but my Florian.
Ser Dontus had promised he would help her escape, but not until the night of Joffrey's wedding. The plans had been well laid, her dear, devoted knight-turned-fool assured her. There was nothing to do until then but endure and count the days.
And sup with my replacement.
Perhaps she was doing Margaery Tyrell an injustice. Perhaps the invitation was no more than a simple kindness, an act of courtesy.
It might be just a supper.
But this was the Red Keep. This was King's Landing. This was the court of King Joffrey Baratheon, the first of his name, and if there was one thing that Sansa Stark had learned here, it was mistrust. Even so, she must accept. She was nothing now, the discarded daughter of a traitor, and disgraced sister of a rebel lord. She could scarcely refuse Joffrey's queen-to-be.
I wish the Hound were here.
The night of the battle, Sandor Clegane had come to her chambers to take her from the city, but Sansa had refused. Sometimes she lay awake at night, wondering if she'd been wise. She had his stained white cloak hidden in a cedar chest beneath her summer silks. She could not say why she'd kept it. The Hound had turned craven, she'd heard it said, at the height of the battle. He got so drunk, the imp had to take his men. But Sansa understood. She knew the secret of his burned face.
It was only the fire, he feared.
That night, the wildfire had set the river itself ablaze and filled the very air with green flame. Even in the castle, Sansa had been afraid. Outside, she could scarcely imagine it. Sighing, she got out her quill and ink and wrote Marjorie Tyrell a gracious note of acceptance. When the appointed night arrived, another of the King's Guard came for her. A man as different from Sandor Clegane as, well, as a flower from a dog. The sight of Ser Loras Tyrell standing on her threshold made Sansa's heart beat a little faster. This was the first time she had been so close to him since he had returned to King's Landing, leading the vanguard of his father's host. For a moment, she did not know what to say. "Ser Loras," she finally managed, "you look so lovely." He gave her a puzzled smile.
"My lady is too kind, and beautiful besides. My sister awaits you eagerly."
"I've so looked forward to our supper, as has Marjorie, and my lady grandmother as well."
He took her arm and led her toward the steps.
"Your grandmother?"
Sansa was finding it hard to walk and talk and think all at the same time, with Ser Loras touching her arm. She could feel the warmth of his hand through the silk. "Lady Olena, she is to sup with you as well."
"Oh," said Sansa. "I'm talking to him, and he's touching me. He's holding my arm and touching me."
"The Queen of Thorns, she's called, isn't that right?"
"It is," Ser Loras laughed.
"He has the warmest laugh," she thought as he went on.
"You'd best not use that name in her presence, though, or you'll like to get pricked."
Sansa reddened. Any fool would have realized that no woman could be happy about being called the Queen of Thorns.
"Maybe I truly am as stupid as Cersei Lannister says."
Desperately, she tried to think of something clever and charming to say to him, but her wits had deserted her. She almost told him how beautiful he was, until she remembered she'd already done that.
He was beautiful, though. He seemed taller than he had been when she first met him, but still so lithe and graceful, and Sansa had never seen another boy with such wonderful eyes. "He's no boy, though. He's a man grown, a knight of the King's Guard." She thought he looked even finer in white than in the green and golds of House Tyrell. The only spot of colour in him now was the brooch that clasped his cloak. The rose of Highgarden, wrought in soft yellow gold, nestled in a bed of delicate green jade leaves. Ser Balin Swan held the door of Maegor's for them to pass. He was all in white as well, though he did not wear it half so well as Ser Loras. Beyond the spiked moat, 2 dozen men were taking their practice with sword and shield. With the castle so crowded, the outer ward had been given over to guests to raise their tents and pavilions, leaving only the smaller inner yards for training. One of the Red Wine twins was being driven backward by Ser Talad, with the eyes on his shield. Chunky Ser Kennis of Case, who chuffed and puffed every time he raised his longsword, seemed to be holding his own against Usni Kettleblack. But Usni's brother, Ser Osfrid, was savagely punishing the frog-faced squire, Morris Slint. Blunted swords or no, Slint would have a rich crop of bruises by the morrow. It made Sansa wince just to watch. They have scarcely finished burying the dead from the last battle, and already they are practicing for the next one. On the edge of the yard, a lone knight with a pair of golden roses on his shield was holding off 3 foes. Even as they watched, he caught one of them alongside the head, knocking him senseless. "'Is that your brother?' Sansa asked.
"'It is, my lady,' said Sir Loras. "'Garden often trains against three men, or even four. "'In battle, it is seldom one against one, he says, "'so he likes to be prepared.'
"'He must be very brave.'
"'He is a great knight,' Sir Loras replied. "'A better sword than me, in truth, though I'm the better lance.'
"'I remember,' said Sansa. "'You ride wonderfully, sir.'
"'My lady is gracious to say so. "'When has she seen me ride?'
"'At the Hand's Tourney, don't you remember? "'You rode a white courser, and your armour was 100 different kinds of flowers. "'You gave me a rose, a red rose. "'You threw white roses to the other girls that day.
"'It made her flush to speak of it.
"'You said no victory was half as beautiful as me.'
Sir Loras gave her a modest smile. "'I spoke only a simple truth, that any man with eyes could see.'
"'He doesn't remember,' Sansa realized, startled. "'He's only being kind to me. He doesn't remember me, or the rose, or any of it. She had been so certain that it meant something, that it meant everything. A red rose,
not a white.
"'It was after you unhorsed Sir Robar Royce,' she said desperately. He took his hand from her arm.
"'I slew Robar at Storm's End, my lady.' It was not a boast. He sounded sad.
Him and another of King Renly's Rainbow Guard as well, yes.
Sansa had heard the women talking of it around the well, but for a moment she'd forgotten.
That was when Lord Renly was killed, wasn't it? How terrible for your poor sister.
For Marjorie, his voice was tight. To be sure, she was at Bitterbridge, though. She did not see.
Even so, when she heard...
Sir Loras brushed the hilt of his sword lightly with his hand. Its grip was white leather, its pommel a rose in alabaster. Renly is dead. Robar as well. What use to speak of them?
The sharpness in his tone took her aback.
My lord, I did not mean to give offence, sir. Nor could you, Lady Sansa, Sir Loras replied, but all the warmth had gone from his voice. Nor did he take her arm again. They ascended the Serpentine steps in a deepening silence.
Why did I have to mention Sir Robar? Sansa thought. I've ruined everything. He is angry with me now. She tried to think of something she might say to make amends, but all the words that came to her were lame and weak. "'Be quiet, or you'll only make it worse,' she told herself.
Lord Mace Tyrell and his entourage had been housed behind the royal sept in the long, slate-roofed keep that had been called the Maiden Vault, since King Baelor the Blessed had confined his sisters therein, so the sight of them might not tempt him into carnal thoughts.' Outside its tall carved doors stood two guards in gilded half-helms and green cloaks edged in gold satin, the golden rose of Highgarden sewn on their breasts. Both were seven-footers, wide of shoulder and narrow of waist, magnificently muscled. When Sansa got close enough to see their faces, she could not tell one from the other. They had the same strong jaws, the same deep blue eyes, the same thick red moustaches.
"'Who are they?' she asked Sir Loras, her discomfort forgotten for a moment.
"'My grandmother's personal guard,' he told her. "'Their mother named them Eric and Arik, but grandmother can't tell them apart, so she calls them Left and Right.'
Left and Right opened the doors, and Margaery Tyrell herself emerged and swept down the short flight of steps to greet them.
"'Lady Sansa,' she called. "'I'm so pleased you came. Be welcome.'
Sansa knelt at the feet of her future queen. "'You do me great honour, your grace.'
"'Won't you call me Marjorie? Please rise. Loras, help the Lady Sansa to her feet. Might I call you Sansa?'
"'If it please you.' Sir Loras helped her up.
Marjorie dismissed him with a sisterly kiss and took Sansa by the hand. "'Come, my grandmother awaits, and she is not the most patient of ladies.' A fire was crackling in the hearth, and sweet-smelling rushes had been scattered on the floor. Around the long trestle table, a dozen women were seated. Sansa recognized only Lord Tyrell's tall, dignified wife, Lady Ellery, whose long silvery braid was bound with jeweled rings. Margaery performed the other introductions. There were three Tyrell cousins, Megha and Alla and Eleanor, all close to Sansa's age. Buxom Lady Janna was Lord Tyrell's sister and wed to one of the Greenapple Fussaways. Dainty, bright-eyed Lady Lyonette was a Fussaway as well and wed to Sir Garlan. Septa Nysterica had a homely, puck-scarred face but seemed jolly. Pale, elegant Lady Graceford was with child, and Lady Bulwer was a child, no more than 8. And Mary was what she was to call boisterous plump Meredith Crane, but most definitely not Lady Merryweather, a sultry, black-eyed, Moorish beauty. Last of all, Margaery brought her before the wizened, white-haired doll of a woman at the head of the table. "I am honoured to present my grandmother, the Lady Alina, widow to the late Luther Tyrell, Lord of Highgarden, whose memory is a comfort to us all." The old woman smelled of rose water. "Why, she's just the littlest bit of a thing." There was nothing the least bit thorny about her.
"Kiss me, child,"
Lady Alina said, tugging at Sansa's wrist with a soft spotted hand.
"It's so kind of you to sup with me and my foolish flock of hens."
Dutifully, Sansa kissed the old woman on the cheek. "It is kind of you to have me, my lady."
"I knew your grandfather, Lord Rickard, though not well."
"He died before I was born."
"I am aware of that, child. It's said that your Tully grandfather is dying too, Lord Huster. Surely they told you? An old man, though not so old as me. Still, night falls for all of us in the end, and too soon for some. You would know that more than most, poor child. You've had your share of grief, I know. We are sorry for your losses."
Sansa glanced at Margaery. "I was saddened when I heard of Lord Renly's death, Your Grace. He was very gallant." "You are kind to say so," answered Margaery. Her grandmother snorted.
"Gallant, yes, and charming, and very clean. He knew how to dress, and he knew how to smile, and he knew how to bathe, and somehow he got the notion that this made him fit to be king. The Baratheons have always had some queer notions, to be sure, and it comes from their Targaryen blood, I should think." She sniffed. "They tried to marry me to a Targaryen once, but I soon put an end to that."
"Renly was brave and gentle, grandmother," said Margaery. "Father liked him as well, and so did Loras."
"Loras is young,"
Lady Orlena said crisply,
"and very good at knocking men off horses with a stick. That does not make him wise. As to your father, would that I had been born a peasant woman with a big wooden spoon. I might have been able to beat some sense into his fat head."
"Mother," Lady Ellery scolded.
"Hush, Ellery, don't take that tone with me. And don't call me mother. If I'd given birth to you, I'm sure I'd remember. I'm only to blame for your husband, the Lord Oaf of Highgarden."
"Grandmother," Margaery urged, "mind your words, or what will Sansa think of us?"
"She might think we have some wits about us. One of us, at any rate."
The old woman turned back to Sansa.
"It's treason. I warn them. Robert has 2 sons, and Renly has an older brother. How can he possibly have any claim to that ugly iron chair?" "Tut, tut," says my son. "Don't you want your sweetling to be queen? You Starks were kings once, the Aerons and the Lannisters as well, and even the Baratheons through the female line, but the Tyrells were no more than Stuarts, until Aegon the Dragon came along and cooked the rightful king of the Reach on the Field of Fire. If truth be told, even our claim to Highgarden is a bit dodgy, just as those dreadful Florents are always whining. What does it matter, you ask? Well, of course it doesn't, except to oaths like my son. The thought that one day he may see his grandson with his arse on the Iron Throne makes Mace puff up like, now, what do you call it, Marjorie, you're clever. Be a dear, and tell your poor old half-daft grandmother the name of that queer fish from the Summer Isles, that puffs up to 10 times its own size when you poke it.
They call them pufffish, grandmother.
Of course they do. Summer Islanders have no imagination. My son ought to take the pufffish for his sigil. If truth be told, he could put a crown on it, the way the Baratheons do their stag. Mayhap that would make him happy. We should have stayed well out of all this bloody foolishness, if you ask me. But once the cow's been milked, there's no squirting the cream back up her udder. After Lord Pufffish put that crown on Renly's head, we were into the pudding up to our knees. So, here we are to see things through. And what do you say to that, Sansa?
Sansa's mouth opened and closed. She felt very like a pufffish herself. The Tyrells can trace their descent back to Garth Greenhand, was the best she could manage at short notice. The Queen of Thorns snorted.
Tchia! So can the Florence, the Rowans, the Oakharts, and half the other noble houses of the South. Garth liked to plant his seed in fertile ground, they say. I shouldn't wonder that more than his hands were green.
Sansa, Lady Alera broke in, you must be very hungry. Shall we have a bite of boar together and some lemon cakes?
Lemon cakes are my favourite, Sansa admitted.
So we have been told, declared Lady Alena, who obviously had no intention of being hushed. That Varys creature seemed to think we should be grateful for the information. I've never been quite sure what the point of a eunuch is, if truth be told. It seems to me they're only men, with the useful bits cut off. Ellery, will you have them bring the food, or do you mean to starve me to death? Here, Sansa, sit here, next to me. I'm much less boring than these others. I hope that you're fond of fools.
Sansa smoothed down her skirts and sat. I think
fools, my lady. You mean the sort in Motley?
Feathers, in this case. What do you imagine I was speaking of? My son, or these lovely ladies? Now, don't blush. With your hair, it makes you look like a pomegranate. All men are fools, if truth be told, but the ones in Motley are more amusing than ones with crowns. Marjorie, child, summon Butterbumps. Let us see if we can't make Lady Sansa smile. The rest of you, be seated. Do I have to tell you everything? Sansa must think that my granddaughter is attended by a flock of sheep.
Butterbumps arrived before the food, dressed in a jester suit of green and yellow feathers with a floppy coxcomb. An immense round fat man, as big as 3 moon boys, he came cartwheeling into the hall, vaulted onto the table, and laid a gigantic egg right in front of Sansa.
"Break it, my lady," he commanded.
When she did, a dozen yellow chicks escaped and began running in all directions.
"Catch them!" Butterbumps exclaimed.
Little Lady Bulwer snagged one and handed it to him, whereby he tilted back his head, popped it into his huge rubbery mouth, and seemed to swallow it whole. When he belched, tiny yellow feathers flew out of his nose. Lady Bulwer began to wail in distress, but her tears turned into a sudden squeal of delight when the chick came squirming out of the sleeve of her gown and ran down her arm. As the servants brought forth a broth of leeks and mushroom, Butterbumps began to juggle, and Lady Alena pushed herself forward to rest her elbows on the table.
"Do you know my son, Sansa, Lord Pufffish of Highgarden?"
"A great lord," Sansa answered politely.
"A great oaf," said the Queen of Thorns. "His father was an oaf as well. My husband, the late Lord Lufa. Oh, I loved him well enough, don't mistake me. A kind man and not unskilled in the bedchamber, but an appalling oaf all the same. He managed to ride off a cliff whilst hawking. They say he was looking up at the sky and paying no mind to where his horse was taking him. And now my oaf son is doing the same, only he's riding a lion instead of a palfrey. It's easier to mount a lion, and not so easy to get off, I warned him. but he only chuckles. Should you ever have a son, Sansa, beat him frequently so he learns to mind you. I only had the one boy, and I hardly beat him at all, so now he pays more heed to butterbumps than he does to me. A lion is not a lapcat, I told him, and he gives me a tut-tut, mother. There is entirely too much tut-tutting in this realm, if you ask me. All these kings would do a great deal better if they put down their swords and listened to their mothers.
Sansa realized that her mouth was open again. She filled it with a spoon of broth, while Lady Ellery and the other women were giggling at the spectacle of Butterbumps bouncing oranges off his head, his elbows, and his ample rump.
"I want you to tell me the truth about this royal boy," said Lady Alena abruptly. "This Joffrey."
Sansa's fingers tightened around her spoon.
"The truth? I can't. Don't ask it, please. I can't.
You, yes. Who would know better? The dad seems kingly enough, I'll grant you. A bit full of himself, but that would be his Lannister blood. We've heard some troubling tales, however. Is there any truth to them? Has this boy mistreated you?"
Sansa glanced about nervously. Butterbumps popped a whole orange into his mouth, chewed and swallowed, slapped his cheek, and blew seeds out of his nose. The women giggled and laughed. Servants were coming and going, and the maiden vault echoed to the clatter of spoons and plates. One of the chicks hopped back onto the table and ran through Lady Graceford's broth. No one seemed to be paying them any mind, but even so, she was frightened. Lady Olena was growing impatient.
"Why are you gaping at Butterbumps? I asked a question. I expect an answer. Have the Lannisters stolen your tongue, child?"
Sir Dontus had warned her to speak freely only in the Guardswood.
King Joffrey, his grace is very fair and handsome and as brave as a lion."
"Yes, all the Lannisters are lions, and when a Tyrell breaks wind, it smells just like a rose," the old woman snapped. "But how kind is he? How clever? Is he a good heart, a gentle hand? Is he chivalrous as befits a king? Will he cherish Margaery and treat her tenderly, protect her honour as he would his own?"
"He will," Sansa lied. "He is very, very comely."
"You said that. You know, child, some say that you are as big a fool as Butterbumps here. And I am starting to believe them. Comely? I've taught my Margaery what comely is worth, I hope. Somewhat less than a mummer's fart. Arian Brightfire was comely enough, but a monster all the same. The question is, what is Joffrey?"
She reached to snag a passing servant.
"I am not fond of leeks. Take this broth away and bring me some cheese."
"The cheese will be served after the cakes, my lady."
"The cheese will be served when I want it served, and I want it served now."
The old woman turned back to Sansa.
"Are you frightened, child?" "No need for that. We're only women here. Tell me the truth. No harm will come to you."
"My father always told the truth." Sansa spoke quietly, but even so it was hard to get the words out.
"Lord Eddard, yes. He had that reputation. But they named him traitor, and took his head off even so."
The old woman's eyes bore into her, sharp and bright as the points of swords.
"Joffrey," Sansa said, "Joffrey did that. He promised me he would be merciful and cut off my father's head. He said that was mercy, and he took me up on the walls and made me look at it. The head. He wanted me to weep, but—"
She stopped abruptly and covered her mouth.
"I've said too much. Oh, gods be good, they'll know, they'll hear. Someone will tell on me."
"Go on." It was Margaery who urged, Joffrey's own queen-to-be. Sansa did not know how much she had heard.
"I can't. What if she tells him? What if she tells? He'll kill me for certain, then, or give me to Sir Ilion.
I never meant—my father was a traitor.
My brother as well. I have the traitor's blood. Please, don't make me say any more.
Calm yourself, child, the Queen of Thorns commanded.
She's terrified, grandmother. Just look at her.